Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and Happy New Year to you. Are you hungover? Are you just waking up? It's 9:59, in case you're wondering and too disoriented to look at a clock. What? Oh, right, 9:59 in the morning. Yes, coming on 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Warm Earth Time, January 1st, 2016. And for our first program of the year, we will look back at 2015 and look forward into 16. Good morning again, everyone. We have the great prognosticator Nate Silver, the database predictor of sports and presidential elections, coming on today, and the historian and former Newsweek editor John Meacham, who has written about George H.W. Bush. Do you know 2016 is the 25th anniversary year since a George Bush first invaded Iraq? Are we better off than if we had left Saddam Hussein alone in 1991? I will challenge John Meacham on that later on. And we'll hear some of your phone calls on how your 2015 New Year's resolutions worked out. Did you lose that weight? Did you quit that lousy job and start your business? Did you reduce your carbon footprint? Did you force your boyfriend to change his personality? We'll hear the resolution to some of your New Year's resolutions made a year ago today. Our first guests of the year, however, will be a parade of WNYC All-Stars with a little New Year's morning show and tell. Beware of journalists bearing sound bites of 2015, serious and wacky, and hopefully some smart conversation that they will inspire about where we are and who we are as a city and as a region and as a nation as 2016 gets underway. Let me bring in right away our All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd. One of my top news stories of 2015 is Jamie coming on board as our afternoon host with her experience as a lawyer and a legal analyst, fellow in the Bill Clinton White House. Is that right?
That is correct.
And a mother of two children growing up in the city.
That's right.
With all the relevant experience in the world that that entails. Me too. And so much more that she brings to her reporting. So happy New Year, Jamie Floyd.
What I do not bring is any recollection of what last year's New Year's resolution was. When you ask that question, I can't remember what I resolved to do.
And I'll bet that's true for 80% of everybody. So we'll hear some people who at least remember their New Year's resolutions from last year. And I'll start the show and tell with my own perhaps most memorable moment from this program in 2015. It was June 26th. The Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne was my guest to talk about politics in general. And we weren't expecting during that segment this news that came across the AP wire. So this is me getting chills while reading wire copy and from the website SCOTUS blog to E.J. Dionne. The Supreme Court has just ruled that same-sex couples have the right to marry in all 50 states. This is a 14th Amendment ruling. It's a 5-4 ruling. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion and joins the liberals on the court. Chief Justice Roberts joined Scalia and the others on the conservative side in dissent. Wow. EJD, on your first reaction.
It is remarkable how quickly our country can change. And again, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch what conservative politicians do, because I know a lot of conservatives, serious conservatives, who are against, who in principle thought the court shouldn't rule this way, who said they'd be quietly happy to have this issue settled, because particularly among younger Americans, opposing gay marriage now is a very unpopular position. But this is a breathtaking and historic ruling, and I guess I should say I'm honored to be on your show at a moment like this.
And I'm honored to be having a show at a moment like this. I mean, I'm almost shaking. It's so earth-shattering for so many people. Well, that was about a minute of this show, unforgettable for the host, from June 26, 2015. Jamie Floyd, have you had moments like that as a host? Honestly, I was getting chills again just listening to it. We're supposed to be so detached and analytical most of the time, but sometimes something happens, good or bad, that just gets you in the gut.
Well, these are the kinds of stories that called us to this profession of journalism, right, Brian? And you were absolutely the right host to be in the chair at that moment on that day, and you had the right guest. So it was meant to be. It was a close decision. It wasn't a unanimous decision, but it was, as E.J. Dionne said, one of those historic, what we call landmark decisions. It was authored, as we all expected it would be, by Justice Kennedy in what we lawyers call ringing language. And he talked about the union of marriage being the most profound union for two people who want to make a life commitment of the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. And it was a beautiful opinion. And he'd obviously given it great thought, because the court had moved in this direction in three previous opinions with Justice Kennedy writing in this way before. But this is the landmark decision.
And elsewhere in that stretch of conversation, EJ was saying how sometimes the Supreme Court leads public opinion and sometimes it follows public opinion, and that in this case, the public was ready for this even prior to the court.
Yeah, I think the public was ready. I like to believe, as an idealist, that the court leads, but as I get older, I've seen plenty of examples where it has failed to lead. So perhaps they were following in this case. But either way, this, I think, was the right decision.
Now, we invited you, and as people will hear as this hour progresses, other WNYC reporters, to bring clips from the year, sound bites of show and tell. And as it turns out, the clip that you brought was from the very same day.
Yes, in fact, that's right, because our reporters here at WNYC, and I was brand new at that moment, I really had just walked through the door on June 1st, but I was so proud to have our reporters walk my city on that day and go to significant places for gay New Yorkers on that moment, at that moment. In fact, one person said to his boss, "I'm sorry, but I have to leave because this is too important a day for me not to go to the place that matters most for us, not just here in New York, but nationally." So let's take a listen to some of the sound as that opinion came ringing down.
I told my boss, who's gay, that I wanted to leave my computer and come down to Stonewall, telling him that on my deathbed, I'll remember this day and I don't want to regret it.
So our son is going to know that his moms are equal just as much as the straight parents that he'll go to school with. That's huge. It feels good to be accepted and be equal.
It's a step up in our world that, you know, things are changing in life. You know what I'm saying? Because it is. You know what I'm saying? Right, Manny? Things are changing.
Yeah, sure. Let them be what they want to be. It is what they feel. If that's what they feel, love for each other, let the love take over, because love is everything.
And not everyone, by the way, interviewed there is a gay New Yorker. Those are just New Yorkers who were very happy about that decision. And what I really love about it, Brian, is we journalists like to think that we report the first draft of history. But what's great about Stonewall is that draft was written all those decades ago. And this decision is the end of that chapter, not the beginning. A hard-fought battle ended in the Supreme Court that day, and we were here to report it after so many of our predecessors have been reporting it for decades.
And I just remembered something, because Andrea Bernstein is sitting here.
Yes, she is.
Getting ready to come on in her role as national political correspondent for us. But Andrea, weren't you a caller to the show that morning?
Yes, she was.
Brian, so like so many listeners to the Brian Lehrer Show, I was sitting in a car waiting for the alternate side parking to change when the decision came down, and I heard you say, "I'm shaking," and I realized I was shaking too. So I did what so many New Yorkers want to do, which is to call the show at that moment. And the reason I did is because I was about to get married. I got married on July 5th, just a week after this decision, and I literally couldn't believe it. I spent so much of my life thinking that that decision would never happen. And then it did, and the White House was arrayed in rainbow-colored lights, and the hashtag Love Wins was trending. And for all that has been dark and disheartening and discouraging about this year, it was wonderful to have this moment when actually love did win.
Absolutely. And, you know, the producer said to me in my ear, Andrea's calling in. Andrea's calling in as a caller. Do you want to put her on? So that was pretty unusual. Even though you had the secret line, it was still Andrea's calling in as a caller.
And if anybody wonders, that entire thing was unplanned.
Yeah, and as you say, Brian, it harkens back to the time of interracial marriage. The majority of states here, same-sex couples could marry in 36 states, but the question is whether it would be recognized as a constitutional right for all in all states. And when you go from one state to the next, would it be recognized and all of the benefits that come with marriage?
And if I could just say one more thing about this, because people joke with me because I'd been with my now wife for 27 years before we got married. So people say, oh, what's married life like? And they think it's a big joke. And actually, it's really great and it's really different.
How?
Well, I would say two ways. First of all, it's very easy to say to people, here's my wife. Everybody understands the relationship. I can throw out that word that I hate, here's my partner, which people just don't know what it means. But you also feel like everybody's rooting for you, that you had this ritual in this very public way, that your friends and family came, that people gave you their thumbs up. But in a way, sort of, you know, the whole world wants marriage to work, and you feel that. I feel that there is a sense of responsibility, even after 27 years, work harder, try harder. This is something that everybody has sort of put their pebbles in with you.
All right. Jamie Floyd, as a Supreme Court watcher, pick any one other case that they ruled on this year and give us a moment of, you know, thinking back.
Yeah,
on
well, there are at least a dozen that I could name, but you've asked for one. And so I'm going to point up one that I think many people probably overlooked, but I think it's fascinating. And that's the Confederate flag and free speech. The court decided a case called Walker versus Texas, Sons of the Confederate Veterans. And this was actually about whether or not you could put a Confederate flag on your license plate. Now, 9 states allowed you to do that. And this goes back to 2011, before we had the horrible shooting just this year in South Carolina, Charleston Church Massacre, we've all come to call it, 9 victims in that church. And it raised again the issue of the Confederate flag as a symbol of hate. The court, in a strange majority, Brian, ruled that states do have the right to reject specialty license plates bearing the Confederate battle flag. But here's the majority, and this is why it's fascinating. It's the 4 you would expect, Sotomayor, Kagan, Ginsburg, and Breyer, with the 5th vote coming from Clarence Thomas after that shooting. Read into it what you will, Brian, but I find it to be a fascinating federal First Amendment case.
And, you know, another coincidence was we had Lawrence Tribe scheduled on the show, the famously liberal Harvard law professor, right around that day, and he took a position against that ruling. He thought it was a defeat for free speech, even though he's, you know, in most of his thinking, a liberal. So legal minds were really divided on this along constitutional lines.
It's a hard case on First Amendment grounds. And generally, Thomas votes with Scalia and the other First Amendment hardliners. But in this one, he came down against that flag.
Now, as a legal analyst and criminal justice reporter in the past, the latest police killings in Chicago and the no charges in the Tamir Rice case in Cleveland just this week, and justified or not, echo with incidents and non-indictments all year. But there also were indictments of police officers in Chicago and in Baltimore and also here in New York in the Brooklyn stairwell shooting. So my question to you as an observer of such incidents is, how much did Black Lives Matter in 2015?
Yeah. Well, you know, Black Lives Matter actually goes back to the Trayvon Martin case. Most people don't know that. They don't think about that. They think it's Ferguson or some other more recent incident. But it goes back to Trayvon Martin and the Zimmerman acquittal. I think people are coming to understand this year that Black Lives Matter is not saying that the lives of African Americans matter more than those of white or other Americans, but that they matter equally and that historically they have been treated as though they do not. And I think we're finally coming to see that in the power of dash cam video and iPhone and handheld bystander video and social media is meaning that maybe Ferguson was the watershed moment that Selma was back in 65, but average Americans are starting to realize what Black Americans have known since Jim Crow, that we have a crisis between policing and communities of color. And we're all waking up as a country to that crisis.
All right. Jamie Floyd, our All Things Considered host and sometime legal analyst, is going to stay with us as we also bring in now two of our very own presidential campaign followers. And really, Andrea Bernstein is still here, and she's been reporting on Hillary Clinton since the 90s, right?
Yes.
And Matt Katz.
The late 90s.
The very late 90s, when Andrea was just 10 years old. And Matt Katz, who first came to fame as the Christie Chronicles columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and more recently the creator of New Jersey Public Radio's Christie Tracker, and now covering the various Republican hopefuls. So hi again, Andrea, and hi, Matt.
Hey. Hi, Brian.
So, Matt, what have you brought for New Year's Show and Tell?
Well, the big news on my beat, obviously, this year was Christie finally, after teasing it and toying with it for years, finally announcing he's running for president of the United States.
Both parties have failed our country. Both parties have stood in the corner and held their breath and waited to get their own way. Both parties have led us to believe that in America, a country that was built on compromise, that somehow now compromise is a dirty word. If Washington and Adams and Jefferson believed compromise is a dirty word, we'd still be under the crown of England.
Matt, both parties.
I thought that was so fascinating because I was reviewing his campaign speech, which came June 30th of 2015, his campaign kickoff speech, because he kind of presented himself in that speech, and this was the soundbite that kind of came out of it, that he, you know, really said that both parties were responsible for dysfunction, and he was running as a new kind of candidate. And yet, the campaign he has run since then has been highly partisan. He has moved to the right overtly on many issues, particularly guns. And this has not been a campaign in which he says, which he blames Republicans, which he says Republicans need to take a hard look at themselves. That was the old Chris Christie. That was a pre-Bridgegate Chris Christie. That was a Chris Christie that, you know, made that remark in the campaign kickoff, but that has not been the campaign he's run. He's run a more hard right campaign, and in recent weeks, it's actually started to work out for him. He appears to be going into the new year in better shape politically than he's been in since I came on your show on January 8th, 2014 and first uttered the words time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, the big smoking gun of the Bridgegate scandal. So he's actually, you know, since the Paris attacks, in fact, since terrorism became this, you know, the top issue in the Republican primary, he has seen a resurgence in his campaign, and they're now talking that he could possibly win the New Hampshire primary.
Of course, he got the endorsement of the major paper there, moved from saying things like both parties do this, both parties should embrace compromise, to I wouldn't even let three-year-old orphans into this country if they're Syrian refugees. But, Matt, I wonder, listening back to that clip and thinking about the origins of the Christie campaign and what he was going to run on, was it always sort of just a little bit of lip service to people for the sake of the general election potentially down the road who remember the moment when he hugged the president after Sandy, and, you know, those flashes of bipartisanship that he can show, just teasing that for future reference if need be, and that he was really going to run this primary campaign to the hard right because that's what you have to do in a Republican primary? Or was he more set to run as a bipartisan new age candidate and then the Trump thing happened where, you know, the party was just so nativist or whatever you call it, and Paris and San Bernardino happened, that he pivoted. How much in reaction to Trump? How much was he going to do this all along?
I think he was really going to run, and I've been told that the plan was for him to run a new kind of Republican campaign where he would have been the guy who said, listen, I won 51% of the Hispanic vote, and we need to appeal to Hispanics, and we need to broaden our tent if we ever hope to win another national election, and I'm the guy who can do that. I won a blue state, and it's about electability, it's about beating Hillary, and it's not about making ourselves, you know, feel good with conservative principles that don't appeal to the general electorate. But he would have, obviously he would have moved to the right. I mean, that's the nature, a little bit. I mean, that's the nature of these things. You have to you have to go to Iowa and say what you have to say. But he ended up doing it much more so. He ended up abandoning the big tent campaign that his advisors had long planned that he would run, because of not only Trump, but because of Bridgegate. I mean, Bridgegate does not really come up on the campaign trail among Republicans in New Hampshire or Iowa, but it damaged him politically. It tarnished his name. It was it put him in a negative light in the media for too many months, and he just didn't have the political. He had so much potency coming out of that reelection in 2013. I mean, he looked like the savior of the party, and because of Bridgegate, and then because of Trump, and how Trump had this tremendous effect on the election, he just couldn't run that big tent Republican campaign.
So he moved to the right to the point where this was the parody of him that Bobby Moynihan did this fall on Saturday Night Live.
We are under attack and we are all going to die. Mothers are putting their kids on buses, and these buses are being driven off cliffs by terrorists. Today, in our great country, one out of every three babies born are already in ISIS. They are here, folks, and I am the only one up here with the stones to take them on. I am a cowboy on a steel horse I ride. Bon Jovi forever!
I have to say, Bobby Moynihan does not do as good a Christie as Larry David does a Bernie Sanders, but still, I wish everybody could see Andrea's face silently
yes.
cracking up, and Jamie
not
Floyd.
Not so silently.
The accent isn't right, but the words are spot on.
Well, and I think if you see the face, you get the whole picture. It does seem, Matt, that Trump, though not running scared, is taking Christie on in a way that suggests that he's starting to really take him seriously in New Hampshire.
Yeah, he teed off on him yesterday with a TV station up in New Hampshire, and he said that he must have known about Bridgegate and that his people didn't know, and if his people did it, and that the governor must have known, and if he didn't, it's a failure of management. He brought up the 9 credit downgrades that the state has faced.
And he brought up Christie's memorable embrace of Barack Obama.
He threw the kitchen sink at him. And, you know, Christie's enjoyed a kind of a little bit of a honeymoon here because he hasn't been a contender. He hasn't been as relevant. But now that he's getting relevant, you're seeing Trump teeing off on him. And Christie was asked about it the next day, and he said, I wish Donald a happy new year, and I look forward to seeing him in New Hampshire. It's very fascinating that Christie, instead of punching back, is going to take some of these punches from Trump, maybe see if Trump gets bored knocking him around, you know, doesn't escalate the whole fight, doesn't force the cable news to relitigate Bridgegate and all of his economic troubles in New Jersey, just kind of tries to ignore it
and
see if that works.
Guy, isn't it?
That doesn't seem like Christie's style.
He's got more self. I've always said he has more self-control than people give him credit for. Yeah. That he seems like he flies off the handle, and he certainly does. But we saw him at that press conference after Bridgegate for 2 hours. And he didn't raise his voice. He didn't yell at a single reporter. He didn't raise his voice. He can control himself when he wants to. And it's going to be a very interesting next 5 weeks in New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah. He did it for 2 hours only. Hillary Clinton did it for 11 hours before the Benghazi committee.
Good points.
And so I rotate to our Clinton correspondent, Andrea Bernstein. What did you bring for New Year's Day, looking back on 2015, show and tell?
So I brought a couple of pieces of tape. The first one is, you know, it's interesting, Jamie. When Brian, when you were talking at the top of the show about Jamie had a piece of tape from the same day as you, the gay marriage, I thought that the tape that you were going to introduce was President Obama singing Amazing Grace, which he did in South Carolina. Also on the day of the Supreme Court decision, he had gone down there for a memorial service after the horrible massacre inside an African-American church in South Carolina. And just 2 weeks after that, I was following Hillary Clinton around South Carolina. And so this had been an extraordinary series of weeks in South Carolina. There was the shooting, the massacre, followed by this dramatic legislative debate about whether they should take the Confederate flag down, which they did. And so it went to Columbia, where the flag had been. And this is clip is from Hillary Clinton speaking to a crowd at a church in Columbia, South Carolina. And she was asked about Black Lives Matter. And her response is this response about African Americans and how they are treated by the U.S. criminal justice system.
If they are stopped, if they are arrested, if they are charged, if they are convicted, if they are sentenced, there are clear, undeniable racial disparities. And so I think we have to admit this. We shouldn't try to gloss it over or pretend that it'll go away because we're just going to be nicer to each other and we're just going to, you know, have conversations. No, we really have to dig deeper.
So this piece of tape really perked up my ears because this was a different Hillary Clinton from the one that I had heard in 2008, from the one in all those other campaigns that I had covered. She was speaking very directly. She was not reeling it in. She was not exercising a great deal of caution. She was being sort of clear. And, you know, one of the things that has really struck me about this campaign is how she is a different candidate. Sometimes I think it's hard for people to hear that because everybody has so much knowledge of Hillary Clinton, and they are constantly having all kinds of incidents, both positive and negative, ringing in their ears. But this was fascinating to me. It was interesting because a little later in the summer, there was a so-called secret video confrontation that was released between her and Black Lives Matter. But you didn't have to have a secret video. I mean, she was out there saying these things in public at her regular campaign town halls.
And you also, go ahead, Jamie.
I was just going to say that Michael Eric Dyson has written that piece on the cover of the New Republic about Black Americans and why they should trust Hillary Clinton as their next president. It's a very controversial piece, even amongst Black Americans, or especially amongst African Americans. Are you saying that she has, in fact, evolved in her thinking or simply become more comfortable in her candidacy?
I think that there is some of both. I mean, also on this trip, she was asked about her support of then-President Bill Clinton's support of the Violent Crime Control Act of 1994,
right,
which was basically the federal law that ended up flooding cities with all kinds of law enforcement personnel. And I was in the political world at that time. I mean, I had just started covering politics, and I do remember this was the time at which crime was at an all-time high, and New York City was just coming off having 2,000 homicides a year. Now it's under 300. And there was a lot of terror, and there was a lot of fear. And in New York City, right before that, David Dinkins was mayor. Mm-hmm. And the headline of the Daily News, the cover of the Daily News, was, "Dave, do something." And this wasn't really coming from white people only. It was coming from a lot of minority communities who felt very threatened. So obviously, there was a severe overcorrection, and Clinton has the baggage of having to explain, well, why did you support that then?
Or at least, why did your husband?
I mean, I think on
and similarly
race
with
issues,
free trade agreements and the deregulation of the banks with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, mm-hmm, things that looked like good ideas at the time that have come back to bite in various ways. She now has to say, well, the world has changed, so I've changed.
Right. So, I mean, I think that it's what's interesting to me, and I haven't sort of fully settled in my mind, is whether the world has evolved closer to who the quote-unquote real Hillary Clinton is, or whether she is so savvy about seizing the political moment that she understands how to ride these things. I think that this tape suggests, this tape doesn't sound like just pure calculation to me. And this is the kind of thing you can hear when you go out and campaign with her. I mean, it's not an isolated incident.
When you think back to the Clinton administration, especially the early years, and Jamie, you were there for a while. And I don't know how this looked from the inside, but the media buzz, and especially the conservative media buzz, was that Hillary is in there tugging Bill to the right, to the left, while he's trying to be a responsible centrist. She's trying to be all liberal on welfare, especially coming out of the Children's Defense Fund, mm-hmm. as she did mm-hmm. with Maron Wright Edelman, and on other things that could be seen as racial, especially female racial yeah. issues.
Yeah, I have to confess, I worked on that crime bill. I don't recall Hillary having anything to do with it. Now, I'm not sitting in the residence at night. Maybe over the dinner table, they're fighting vigorously about the crime bill, and she's pulling him to the left. I don't know. I was trying to pull people to the left. Nobody was listening to me. I was just a kid in the White House. But, you know, those fiefdoms are pretty well carved out. You work on welfare reform. She was working, as we all recall, on health care, and that was a huge, massive effort that required all of her attention at that time.
And it's
so
interesting
to ask her to comment on other policies that went down in the Clinton years. Of course, she should comment. But did she have an active hand in what happened on three strikes or 100,000 new police officers or community policing, all the things we worked on? I don't know that it's fair to.
It's her lodestone. I mean, it's interesting because I think that in 2008, when she ran for president, it was a great advantage because people would say, I like Bill Clinton, so I like Hillary Clinton. And
you get
I think
two for one.
That, you know, now it's not so much an advantage because the political climate has changed so much. But it's interesting that you raise health care because I've been spending a lot of time listening to archival tape over the years. And one of the things that I can say unequivocally is from the 1990s until now, she is absolutely consistent on women's rights, on health care, on education, and on reproductive rights. And, you know, for those people who say, well, she just doesn't have anything that she is committed to, I can assure you that I could play you tape from 1999 that sounds like something she said yesterday on those issues, which are important to a lot of Americans.
And so now Trump is going after her on that, saying that her husband was hardly a feminist in the White House and that she could have been minding the store better and that she's taking money from places that are hardly good to women, companies, and even countries. And I guess he's obviously clearly going to go after Hillary. They all are. But what about some of those points?
Yeah, you know, that leads me into the sort of second piece of tape that I wanted to play, because I think she is very vulnerable on who she takes money from. And she has made a decision, as, for example, President Obama made before, that she is going to participate in the political money system. And Bernie Sanders has not. And I was up in New Hampshire recently. This little piece of clip of tape is two of his organizers talking about what it is that attracts them.
I just want to say that by coming here today, you're doing something incredibly revolutionary. You're challenging the apathy that allows the political establishment to trample on the rights of women and destroy our environment.
The first speech I saw Bernie do, I was with my mom, and she turns to me and she goes, "This is the guy. This is the guy." I think there's a piece of the political revolution in each and every one of you out there.
So that's what Sanders is promising. Revolution. Hillary Clinton is working within the system, and the contributions. You can never speak to people like this and say, yes, the contributions are okay, but, because these are people who actually do want to overthrow the system, you know, not in terms of radical American Revolution type revolution, but they just want to rewrite the rules. That's what Sanders is offering them, and that is very attractive to many Democratic primary voters.
And we haven't really analyzed the Trump campaign in this segment, and we're not going to, because people are doing it everywhere else ad nauseum. I will just say, on the wacky side, that luckily in the digital era, We don't have to just listen to Donald Trump say the same thing over and over again. Clever people, like at Huffington Post, can do their own edits of his speeches, as this video, viewed more than 3 million times on YouTube, has of Trump saying, China.
People from China, they love me.
Right.
China. China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
In China, they say I don't like China. I love China.
People think I don't like China. I love China.
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 Is the new China, by the way.
China.
China.
China. I deal with China.
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 Big league China.
So don't tell me about China. I know China. China.
China. China. China. China. Whether it's China, China.
So if you went to China and you wanted to get a job in China.
I don't knock China. How could I dislike China? A man from China.
An excerpt from a longer piece that goes on for about 3 minutes of Donald Trump saying China in various permutations, viewed more than 3 million times. Hopefully there is no such tape of him saying Mexico, because you'd have to see the look on his face. All right, Matt and Andrea, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Brian. Happy New Year, Jamie.
And
Happy
Jamie's,
New Year to you.
And Jamie's going to stay with us, and we'll bring on three more surprise WNYC All-Stars after this break. Brian Lehrer on New Year's morning on WNYC. It's the best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on New Year's morning. Happy New Year, everybody, with our All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd, and also joining us now with their carefully curated show-and-tell soundbites of 2015, both earnest and wacky, are WNYC Metro editor David Lewis, WNYC Albany correspondent Karen Rouse, and WNYC transportation geek, correspondent Kate Hines. Happy New Year to all of you.
Happy New Year, Brian.
And wait a minute, Brian.
I think, Kate, that you should have a business card that says WNYC transportation geek. It could get you extra access to some people.
Yes, that and 275 will get me on the C-train.
We'll get back to that C-train in a little while. But Karen, let me go to you first. The top New York State story that people have on their lips is the two corruption convictions of Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos in 2015. But it looks like the clip you brought for us takes a much bigger view of the year that Governor Cuomo led you to expect 2015 might have been. Am I overselling it?
I think I expected it to be a bigger year for him. You know, I thought that he didn't really deliver. I thought that given his inaugural speech, we would have seen much more legislation delivered over the course of the session than what we actually saw. He did get things done, but a lot of it was done through executive order, you know, unilateral decisions, rather than being able to get the Senate and the Assembly to work together, which is something I think he took pride in prior years.
It was Cuomo's second inaugural address. And didn't it come on the same day that his father died?
Yeah. You know, his father was not able to be at the first inaugural address. He gave two, one at the World Trade Center and another in Buffalo later in the day. And at the first one, you know, I was there, and it was just really a compelling speech. It was even inspiring. He talked about New Yorkers, and he talked about income inequality, which was a very big issue last year. He talked about women's rights. And another big issue that he talked about was the criminal justice, which you recall the prior year, 2014, was a big issue here in New York with the death of Eric Garner and the decision of the grand jury not to indict. And coming off of all of that, he gave his speech continued into talking about criminal justice. And I thought that was something we would see more of, something that he would really invest in the course of the legislature.
So set up this clip. Where was this?
So at the World Trade Center speech, he spoke about the criminal justice system and what he was seeing in New York. And I thought his voice just sounded, you know, very compelling. And it sounded like he spoke with conviction.
Let's listen.
Our national symbol of justice, Lady Justice, carries a sword, a set of scales, and she also wears a blindfold. Why? To signify objectivity. objectivity that one's wealth, one's class, one's race are irrelevant to the pursuit of justice. But today, sadly, too many people are questioning if the blindfold is still intact. Or does the justice system now see black and white, or black and blue, or rich and poor? The world saw an African-American man in Staten Island die, and people are confused, disappointed, and angry. Law enforcement officials have been wrongfully targeted and even assassinated. The situation has devolved into one which everyone is talking, but no one is listening. It must stop, and it is time for the truth.
So, Karen, what did you hope would happen, and what do you think got in the way? Was it everything being derailed in Albany by Scalise and Silver? Was it that Cuomo didn't mean it or didn't find it politically as necessary as he might have thought at that moment? What do you think happened?
Well, in that speech, he talks about police officers getting assassinated. And I think that, you know, that was something that, you know, created tensions between, of course, we saw between the mayor and the police benevolent association. And I think Cuomo in many ways probably felt like he was in the middle of that. And I think he also, you know, coming off of that speech, I think also within weeks of that speech, you know, he gave a State of the State address. And in that State of the State address, I think that was seen as starting a war with the teachers union because he blamed teachers for why kids fail. And then a day later, as you mentioned, the corruption in Albany, we saw the arrest of Sheldon Silver, the former Speaker of the Assembly. And I think this is a governor that we know likes to be in control of the situation, and he does not like to lose. And I think he lost control once suddenly the people he was used to doing business with, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver and the Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos, who was later indicted during the session, threw that structure off, the structure that he was used to dealing with. And he could not now control the two new leaders of the Assembly and the Senate the way he could the way he was able to in the past.
So David Lewis, maybe this is too much of a psychological question, but do you think that derailment could have had anything to do with the degree to which Cuomo seemed interested in feuding with Mayor de Blasio this year?
I do, as a matter of fact, Brian, because I think governors have a tendency to get jealous of mayors, because mayors deliver a lot more services a lot more directly than governors do. Mostly governors in New York State give out money and pass regulations, and to not be able to reform the criminal justice system through executive action the way a mayor can, I think does heighten tensions. And I think that Governor Cuomo is a little bit jealous of Mayor de Blasio. And we have an example, actually, of what Karen was talking about earlier, where there was a movement in the legislature to create a special prosecutor to prosecute these deaths in police custody, and he wasn't able to get it through the legislature. It's unclear how much political capital he actually expended on it, but what he did instead was do this, as Karen mentioned, executive action to appoint the attorney general for a year to handle these cases.
So you've got a Cuomo clip?
I have got a Cuomo. I have a clip of Mayor de Blasio talking about his differences, shall we say, with Governor Cuomo.
So we've seen it time and time again. I'm not going to be surprised if these statements lead to some attempts at revenge, and we'll just call them right out because we're just not going to play that way. We're not going to accept that as anything like acceptable government practice. And I think all over the state people are coming to the same conclusion. You know, we are supposed to be serving our constituents, and we're supposed to be putting forward ideas, and when we disagree, we're supposed to try and resolve the disagreements, not engage in political games.
And so, I think what we're seeing here is really the difference between these two men. So Bill de Blasio takes office, and he's an idealist, and he thinks everything should be decided on policy, value of the policy. And he accuses Cuomo of being, oh, my gosh, a transactionalist, conducting politics through transactions, which is the way Andrew Cuomo grew up, watching politics being conducted that way. So that is also at the heart of the differences between these two men.
Well, here you get Bill de Blasio on the one hand, who tries to govern out of principle, as you were just describing, as opposed to, say, Dean Skelos, and oh, by the way, his son, who are caught on tape talking to each other as part of the scandal. And this other clip that you brought, Karen, is really one of the unbelievable, unforgettable, eye-popping moments of the year. You want to set it up?
Yeah, so this was the corruption trial of Senator Dean Skelos and his son Adam Skelos. And you recall he was accused of using his position to enrich his son, shaking down people who had business before the state in order to get money for his son, you know, no-show jobs, checks for tens of thousands of dollars. And so in this discussion, in this cut here, the two of them are realizing that there are investigations going on in Albany. Adam is upset in this tape because someone he is supposed to meet with has just canceled a meeting. And his father knows that there is, both of them know that they need to be careful, and you could kind of hear that going on.
I'm going to be very, very vague. I don't work with that person anymore. He's just a friend.
You know what?
I don't work with that person anymore.
Right.
He's with a totally separate group. And he's also a registered lobbyist, which is why I had nothing to do with the meeting, but to cancel it hurts him.
All right. You know what? Let me talk to you about it tomorrow. And if it's appropriate, we'll get it rescheduled. Right now, we are in dangerous times, Adam.
Right, Brian. So you asked me earlier about what kinds of things may have gotten in the way of Cuomo making progress. And I think this illustrates part of that people in Albany knew, you know, lobbyists, legislators, people who do business with the state knew that investigations were going on, and you hear the fear in their voices. You also saw that in the legislature, a lot of work was not getting done. People were afraid to make decisions. People were afraid to do this. People were afraid to do the sort of backroom deals that they were used to doing for years because they didn't know who was watching. And I think Cuomo was part of that, that he also was very cautious.
One of the things that they went back and forth on, Cuomo and de Blasio, was funding for the MTA. Cuomo first.
I'm proud to fund the $8 billion. But 80% of it is in New York City, and that's where these benefits are going to go.
And Mayor de Blasio.
There's been a bad history over the last few years of the state government taking money out of the MTA and putting it into the state budget.
So, Kate Hines, transportation reporter, they both love public transit. They both support the MTA. Was this just your run-of-the-mill negotiation that's going to take place between a city government and a state government as to who shells out more bucks?
No, this was, I think, their political feud writ large. It started last year when the MTA presented its roughly $30 billion capital program, which has to be signed off by a state board. And then, you know, negotiations continued behind the scenes, as it always does every 5 years when the capital plan is presented and goes through the process of being approved. But maybe 6 months after the capital program was unveiled, you know, in the spring, it was clear that things were starting to derail. The head of the MTA, who is sort of like Governor Cuomo's proxy in this battle, it starts saying he wants the city to give more money to the MTA capital plan. And this is before the state had even ponied up what its contribution was going to be. And Mayor de Blasio starts pushing back, saying, you know, if we give more to the MTA, we want more control. And the two sides just got so entrenched. And I could have picked like six more pieces of tape of them saying basically the exact same thing. You know, the Cuomo would say, look, the MTA is in the city. It benefits you. I'm happy to pay more, but you have to pay more. And de Blasio saying, I'll pay more. I'll pay money, but I want some control over where it goes, and I don't want you to take it out of the budget.
So how much, David Lewis, is this emblematic of Mayor de Blasio's year? You know, to read the tabloids, he fought with Cuomo over this and that and lost. There are more homeless people on the street, and his poll numbers are down. Is it better than that?
Well, it is a little better than that. And even on this MTA issue, if you look at the outcome, the city did end up putting in more money, and at least ostensibly got a little bit more say in how that money was going to be spent. So the mayor has been getting into these fights with the governor, and the governor has been winning a lot of battles, but the war is not over yet, I think.
And this is the two-year mark. He was sworn in New Year's Day 2 years ago, Bill de Blasio. He certainly can say he got his pre-K program implemented. I think we can say he leveraged Governor Cuomo into that and into endorsing a $15 minimum wage for New York State, which really came more from the de Blasio camp.
Yes, and his approval ratings are below 40% right now. So it's a little bit head scratching. I think our mayor spent the first 2 years of his administration sort of serving the people who elected him, and then he's just starting to learn that when you're governing, you know, you have to govern for everybody. You can't just govern for the people who elected you. It's very tempting for politicians, and this is a lesson that's especially hard for politicians to learn who haven't served in the executive office before. It's very tempting for politicians to play to the people who their supporters and the people who elected them, and I think he's just learning now that he's got to do more, and so we'll see what happens over the next 2 years.
Which job is harder, governor of New York or mayor of New York? Well, I've wanted to ask you this question since I met you. Now I have the opportunity.
Well, the old saying is that being mayor of New York is the second hardest job in the United States, and the first hardest job, of course, is being president of the United States. So, you know, the mayor of New York is responsible for every pothole in the street.
Yeah.
You know, you run over a pothole, you say, darn it, de Blasio, fix it, right?
Even if it dates back to LaGuardia.
You don't say, darn it, Cuomo, fix it.
And the mayor is even responsible for telling people how to behave on the subway.
Don't be the guy that keeps the 50-pound backpack on the subway, man. Come on. Take it off and put it between your feet. It's common sense.
All right, that was a Kate Hines Transportation Geek special. Why'd you bring that clip in your grab bag today?
Because earlier this year, the MTA kicked off a subway etiquette campaign. And, you know, Mayor de Blasio often takes it on the chin for not riding the subway very often. You know, he drives around in a motorcade. He takes private cars to the Y in Park Slope. And I think here he's trying to be sort of the everyman and be funny at the same time. You know, everybody in New York City is paying attention to man spreading. And
how's backpacks. That etiquette campaign going there, Kate?
Well, I feel like everyone has to do their part, Jamie, and I personally shamed a tourist into picking a wrapper up off the ground through the sheer force of my disapproving stare earlier this week. So I feel like it's going very well.
But that's the de Blasio that New Yorkers don't get to see that often, right? He sounded almost like Ed Koch there. Come on!
Probably by design, right? I'm going to do my Ed Koch imitation now. All right, we're almost out of time. I promised we would get to your C-Train clip, Kate. You want to set this up?
Sure. For a story that I did about old C-Train cars earlier this year, I spoke to a former C-Train conductor who was explaining to me that I had this idea that the C-Train was kind of treated badly among the MTA family of cars because it's a relatively small line. It serves a relatively small number of people, and the cars that are on it are kind of workhorses, and they've been in service for over 50 years. And I asked the conductor, am I right about this? How does the MTA view the C-Train? And this is what he said to me.
They get treated like the stepchild. It's the Cinderella without the glass slipper coming. That's how the C-Train is treated.
And since that speaks for itself, that is where we are going to leave it with WNYC Metro editor David Lewis, WNYC Albany correspondent Karen Rouse, and WNYC Transportation Geek, correspondent Kate Hines. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks,
Jamie Martin. Floyd, thank you very much.
Happy New Year.
We'll keep hearing you on All Things Considered. Thanks to all of you for starting off 2016 and getting our listeners one more hour into the new year without reaching for another aspirin too desperately. Nate Silver, the great prognosticator from 538, coming up after the latest news, live right now from the WNYC newsroom. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Is there any way to predict what will happen in 2016 that's based on science, not the psychic in the window? The answer is yes, and there's no one better at it, at least when it comes to the presidential race, than Nate Silver, editor-in-chief of the data-crunching website 538, formerly associated with the New York Times, now housed at ABC News and ABC's ESPN network, because Nate also analyzes sports. But remember, 538 refers to the number of electoral votes in a presidential election. I predict, by the way, since he does this with ESPN too, that we will utter the name Kristaps Porzingis again before the end of this segment. Hi, Nate Silver. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. How are you?
Good, thanks. I really liked how you looked at data recently to measure the relationship between Donald Trump's lead in the Republican primary polls and his media coverage. For example, you conclude that Trump has been getting about the most disproportionate media coverage ever for a primary candidate. Disproportionate to what?
Disproportionate to his likelihood of winning the race, but even relative to his polls. So he's gotten about 55% of the media coverage since July, polling at 25 or 30%, which is good, better than I thought he would do. But still, it's about twice as much media coverage as his popular support. And lately, his polls have gone up, but not coincidentally, so has his media coverage. Since his comment about Muslims not being able to enter the United States this month, he's gotten 70% of the media coverage in a field that has 14 candidates, or 13 with Lindsey Graham dropping out now.
And you have Jeb Bush next in second place, and he only gets in single digits percent of the media coverage. So that's how wide the gulf is between Trump and anybody else. Wow.
Yeah, and people, you know, we hear sometimes from on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders supporters complain about how their candidate's not being heard about or heard from very often. For the GOP, everyone is kind of Bernie Sanders except Donald Trump, who is so often the focal point of any discussions you have in any kind of form of media you want to look at.
Did you look at Clinton versus Trump on media coverage?
So there's been more coverage of the GOP race overall, in part because it's more interesting. Even I would concede that, I think. So Clinton gets about, I think, 77% of coverage in the Democratic race. So she's higher than Trump as a share. But remember, that's really a two-candidate race, or three, yeah, if you want to be generous to Martin O'Malley.
So how about Clinton versus Sanders, since the complaint is that he gets undercovered?
I mean, so if anything, Clinton's coverage has gone up. There was a lot of coverage of this Democrats in disarray notion earlier in the fall, and then after Biden. I mean, that was the thing. If I were a Bernie fan, I'd say the press gave as much coverage to a candidate who wasn't running, Joe Biden, as they did to Bernie Sanders at times. But the broader point here is that if you're looking at polls that are dependent on kind of whose people's names are in the news, then you have to consider the fact that all voters have heard about is Donald Trump on the GOP side and Hillary Clinton, yeah, on the Democratic side.
So you wrote up a cycle we've seen with Trump and the media. He says something offensive or ludicrous. Some pundits say this could sink his campaign. Instead, he stays the same or goes up. Then the same pundits conclude he's indestructible or his support is impervious to criticism. But you don't buy that conclusion. Why might it be wrong?
I think partly because when you have, so believe it or not, as contentious as a GOP primary is, most Republicans like several different candidates. They might say, you know, there are six or seven or eight candidates, in fact, I'm still considering. If you have six options you like, how do you decide which one name to volunteer when a pollster calls you? Well, it might be the name that's been in the news the most recently that's top of mind, and Trump is extremely good at staying top of mind. So when he says something about Muslims or Mexicans or about Vladimir Putin, that ensures that the election becomes a referendum on Donald Trump. And he's actually not the most popular guy if you look at favorability ratings. There are a number of Republicans who don't like him very much. But if it's between Trump and everyone else, instead of a true 14-way race, then he tends to rise in the polls. The question we have is, will that translate into Iowa and New Hampshire, and Iowa, where voters are more informed? Trump is not doing as well. He's probably behind Ted Cruz already, and so there's some evidence that as voters learn more about the other candidates, then Trump becomes less dominant.
You compare Trump and the media in certain ways to the Howard Dean campaign in 2004 and the Jesse Jackson campaign in 1984. Want to give us one of those?
I mean, the Dean campaign is an interesting comparison, and I don't know if you can compare the two politically. Dean had a more serious, in my view, agenda. However, he was also a guy where he was by far the most exciting thing going on in a very crowded 2004 Democratic race, and his numbers look pretty similar to Trump's right now. He was at about 35%, or up about, 10 or 15 points in the national polls, but was starting to fade a little bit in Iowa. And once he lost Iowa, the media turned on him. You had the Dean scream, more of a symptom than a cause, but still, he faded very quickly and had this very large lead in New Hampshire. He was from Vermont, lost that lead quickly. So we haven't really had a moment yet where we've seen what happens when Donald Trump looks like a loser for a day. Maybe he won't. Maybe he'll sweep through everything. But I think there's a big problem for him in Iowa, where how does he react to Iowa, and how does that halo of leading everything in the polls and being a winner, if he loses Iowa, wear off? So Iowa is always important. I think it's especially important for Donald Trump.
And Jesse Jackson, who, if he's listening now, is probably thinking, don't compare me in any way with Donald Trump, please.
Yeah, and I know these historical comparisons can seem strained. The thing, though, about Jesse Jackson was he was a guy who was renowned, respected by some, disliked by others before he got into politics. And I know this is a little bit before my time, but reading accounts from the time, to have Jesse Jackson run for president was a huge deal. It meant that between Mondale and Hart, where would black support, it was supposed to go to Mondale, where would that go? Also, he did a lot for voting rights and participation in the African-American community. So it was a big deal to have this kind of controversial civil rights leader get in the race. Not the same type of candidate as Trump, but in terms of being a media sensation and draining away coverage from the rest of the candidates, then there was some of that with Jackson in 84.
Nate Silver from 538. We can take a few phone calls, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Have you measured positive versus negative media coverage of Trump? The cycle you described suggests he mostly gets blasted.
Well, yeah, it's mostly it's mostly negative coverage, I think, for most candidates now. But Trump's coverage is negative, and I think what he's proven is that in politics, when you just want to stand out from a very crowded field, that almost any coverage is good coverage. There are also cases where, for example, the ban he's proposed on Muslims entering the United States is fairly popular with a certain segment of the GOP. I'll be interested to see what happens to his numbers after these Vladimir Putin comments. You'd think that there's not a big Putin constituency among Republicans, but even so, things he says that can be ridiculous, that people can dislike, like the John McCain comments, because they make sure that he is still the focal point of the race and all voters can think about, that seems to help his poll numbers in the short term.
The Putin comment is what? Just that he tried to work with him, or what?
Well, he's praised Vladimir Putin and said, well, Vladimir Putin's a real leader, and I'm not so worried if he kills journalists. He has the support of his people. So it's, Donald Trump has some weird chinks in his armor in terms of his conception of the world. But still, those Putin comments ensured that you weren't going to have discussion about Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Chris Christie. That was going to be more news cycles full of Trump.
I ask about positive and negative media coverage of Trump, partly because I think there's one theory that says it doesn't matter generally whether you get blasted as a bigot or a fascist in the media in general. Just repeating your bigoted fascist positions enough next to your name makes your poll numbers go up. That's why some liberal Trump haters asked me not to do many segments about him on the show. But those same liberals complain that Mayor de Blasio's poll numbers are going down because he gets such negative press. And I think, both things probably can't be true. So can Nate Silver Analytics begin to tell me which thing is true?
I mean, so one thing to think about with Trump, though, is that people are looking at polls of Republican primary voters. Overall, he's not very popular. So overall, he has about 60% unfavorable rating and a 30% favorable rating. So it's a really big lopsided against him number. So, you know, it's kind of looking – it's forgetting sometimes that the GOP is only about 25 to 30% of the American electorate. People who are voting in GOP primaries is a smaller share of that still. Even in high turnout states relative to other states like New Hampshire, you're still only having a fairly small fraction of the state vote in the primary there. And so people are trying to find a very small fraction of the electorate. It's ironic, too, that Trump does better, though, with non-traditional voters. So the traditional kind of establishment Republican who might have a college degree, you know, he or she is not especially likely to support Donald Trump. But this larger universe of people who do not usually participate in politics are very intrigued by Trump. We'll see, though, whether they wind up actually turning out in Iowa and New Hampshire. He apparently does not have, from good reporting we've seen, apparently does not have the turnout operation that you would associate with the front runner in Iowa.
So negative press, net negative?
In the long run, it could be. And this part of what I try to get people to separate out is the long term versus the short term. In the short term, if you make any type of noise, you may go up in the polls. In the long term, Donald Trump is making it very, very hard for Republican leaders to ever turn around and support him later. In fact, you hear reporting in the Washington Post about how Republicans are so reluctant to nominate Trump that they would prefer a brokered convention to prevent him from being nominated. Ordinarily, it's the opposite, because a brokered convention is such a disaster for party unity. You do everything you can to avoid it. But because Trump is even worse in the sense he'd probably lose to Clinton or to Sanders, and he doesn't really represent the conservative ideas they want on the table, he represents controversial ideas instead, they're going to fight as much as they can to prevent him from being the nominee. And so, therefore, the process you see 4 years ago, where after Iowa and New Hampshire, Mitt Romney did pretty well, people consolidate around him or around John Kerry in 2004, you're not going to have that consolidation process around Trump if he does well in the early states, which he still could. Conversely, if he doesn't do well, then I think they might say, well, you know what, Ted Cruz might not be perfect, but Ted Cruz is our best bet, or Rubio, or whatever else. But that dynamic is different than what we've seen in the past.
Nate Silver from the data crunching site 538, and Ethan in Manhattan has a question for you. Ethan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, thank you, Brian. First, I want to say, Mr. Silver, I'm a big fan, a lot of respect. I wanted to say in 2012 especially, you're one of those people when everybody was worried that Mitt Romney was going to win, you were saying, oh, well, it's not over till it's over, and everybody hold your breath. So I really appreciate that, but I think so much has changed now that...
And then he,
you know,
predicted how all the states went in their electoral votes, just saying.
Right, it was amazing. It was almost like magic. And I'm wondering if that still holds for 2015 and 2016, considering how much polling really has become, left behind in terms of landline phones, or that it's being done with registered voters for the most part, as opposed to leaving out independents, where people have never voted before.
So if your successful predictions, I guess he's asking, are based on really close, good analysis of many, many, many polls, if those polls feeding your analysis are worse than they were in the past, then what does that do to you?
Then it means the margins of error are higher. And absolutely, we had pretty good polling in 2012, but in the 2014 midterms, the polling was not great in other countries. There have been problems in other democracies like Israel and the United Kingdom. So there definitely is reason to worry when it's becoming harder and harder to contact people on phones. Ironically, right now I'm in a spot where I'm saying, you know, on the GOP side, it's still too early to look at polls, obviously way too early to look at general election polls. But, you know, I hope at 538 we provide ample caution, and you kind of go back and say, well, if not polls, then what do you look at? In the primaries, you look at the combination of, is a candidate representing the party well? So is a Democrat mostly liberal? Is a Republican mostly conservative? And are they electable or not? Trump has not really been a Republican for all that long, and he's not very electable. And so you think if GOP voters come to their senses, he would be a fairly terrible choice as compared to someone like a Rubio, say, or even a Cruz, who for better or worse, is in line with where that party's agenda is right now. So that's part of the reason for my skepticism of where the polls are right now, is that polls are not magic, and especially in the primaries, they're often misleading until very close to the actual voting. Once people vote and we know how does this hypothetical national primary support translate into actual likely voters and real voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, until we see that, one should be very cautious based on what the polls say.
There's a theory about Trump that his poll numbers are actually undercounting the percentage of the vote he'll get, because polls tend to count past voters as the likely voters, but Trump is going to bring out all these disaffected folks who have not shown up in recent elections. How much do you buy that?
So based on the report, and we have a reporter out in Iowa and other organizations do too, based on the reporting we've seen, that would take some kind of taking voters hand in hand to the caucus sites in Iowa, and Trump doesn't seem to have that very much. So if you told me that, by the way, Donald Trump, maybe he seems like he's a big media personality, but, oh, by the way, he's really well organized in Iowa, then I'd say, oh, sure, this guy has a real shot to do something unprecedented. But the fact that he seems not to be focused on the ground game very much and he has non-traditional voters, that combination seems like a poor one for him. Maybe famous last words, but you kind of see how he's not doing as well in Iowa as other states, and those voters are a little bit more informed on how his turnout and ground game isn't great there, and he would not be the first candidate for Iowa to be his downfall, potentially.
Hey, I see you watch not just the polls on the presidential candidates, but the betting markets, and so do I. I find them really interesting, since people who think they can predict as well as you do are placing actual cash dollars. And there on the Republican side, Marco Rubio has been leading for a long time. I think his current odds are 9-2, the last I looked the other day, which is the best. What wisdom or what biases do the betting markets tend to reflect, in your opinion?
I mean, the betting markets in some ways are a distillation of conventional wisdom, and so whatever flaws there are in conventional wisdom, they tend to be replicated there. But at least people are putting money on the line and trying to quantify things. And they see a three-way race between Rubio, Ted Cruz, and Donald Trump, which I think is a reasonable enough way to look at how the primary is right now. I tend to think of those three, Trump is the least likely to actually win the nomination eventually, but there's no doubt that he's having a lot of influence on the race. But Rubio has actually faded a bit in those markets over the past couple of weeks. I think as people have said, I see the theoretical appeal of Marco Rubio, but at some point it's got to translate into something more tangible, whether that's, you know, running first place in New Hampshire or having a big fundraising quarter or getting a lot of endorsements or something. And so far we've seen Rubio kind of, I guess, be pretty cautious and conservative, and there's nothing yet to hang your hat on about him. So I think the theory is that by process of elimination, Donald Trump would not be an acceptable nominee to GOP insiders. Ted Cruz, not that well liked by his colleagues, and so conservative that could cost the GOP some votes in the McGovern kind of way. Therefore, by default, it must be Rubio. And I totally get the logic there. I'm still fairly bullish on Rubio, I guess. But, you know, at some point something has to click there for Rubio to actually start to rise in the polls and the markets and other indicators of success.
I see your colleague Harry Enten at 538 wrote a piece that goes against the conventional wisdom titled Bernie Sanders Can Still Catch Hillary Clinton in Iowa. Looks like his argument is based on history. Do you know it enough to comment?
For sure. I mean, you know, in what I think is the best poll of Iowa, which is the Des Moines Register and Seltzer poll, Bernie Sanders is only 9 points behind in Iowa. To be 9 points behind 6 weeks before a caucus is not that large a deficit. In fact, if you're 9 points behind on the morning of the caucus, sometimes you have a really strong turnout operation, then that can be overcome. Hillary overcame a deficit like that in New Hampshire in 2008. So what would concern me about Clinton is not that Bernie Sanders is close, but that now media expectations are that she will win Iowa, and if she were to lose or come really close to losing, that creates momentum for Bernie. He then probably wins New Hampshire, which is right next door to him. And then, well, then frankly, Hillary probably comes back in the South where she's leading, you know, 60% to 15% in some polls. But still, that would make for some drama. So I think Iowa is somewhere where I'd be wary, I guess, if I were Clinton.
Okay, before you go, put on your sports analytics hat for a minute and tell me about Kristaps Porzingis, who I saw you wrote about the other day. For people who don't know yet, he is the really tall rookie phenom for the Knicks. Your article on him is called Kristaps Porzingis is a Freak and Potentially a Superstar. Can you give me the freak part first?
So the freak part is you've never had a player like this who was so young. He's only 20. He's 7'3", and he can shoot three-pointers. And he's not that awkward, too. He's, like, fairly mobile. So you've never had a player with this skill set so young before. You know, people compare him to Dirk Nowitzki, but he's taller than Dirk Nowitzki and actually a little bit better than Dirk was at the same age. So this is really the most exciting thing for the Knicks since Linsanity. But frankly, this guy, I think, being so young, so tall, and skilled, has a lot more upside than Jeremy Lin did.
Did the people who predict sports not see this coming? Because the pick by the Knicks of him in the draft over some other people who were available was roundly booed.
It was roundly booed, and this looks like a brilliant pick so far. So, you know, score one for Phil Jackson. But because the rep for a while was that, oh, the Knicks took another European guy. These guys haven't really performed well in New York. But you take a kid who's 7'3", who's that young and has real basketball skills, and, you know, I'm sure there are other GMs who will be scratching their heads and saying, why did I not have Porzingis as my number one or number two? You know, Okafor, who some Knicks fans were hoping for, is in Philly instead and having a kind of disastrous year on and off court. And so in the NBA draft, what seems like a curse can turn out to be a blessing instead.
Well, Nate Silver, if history is the best guide to predicting the future, as you often tell us, I predict you will have great success in 2016 predicting outcomes in the presidential campaign, and I predict I will be checking in regularly to read you on 538. Thanks for doing this, and happy election year.
Definitely. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. John Meacham next, talking about George H.W. Bush and how anxious he was to go to war against Iraq in 1990 and 91, more, Meacham reveals in his book, than the Saudis or Jordan, who were the ones Iraq was supposedly threatening. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and 2016 marks a quarter century since the United States invaded Iraq, and we're still bogged down. If you're thinking, no, it's not that long, we invaded in 2003. Well, that was George W. Bush's follow-up invasion to intensify what his father had started. John Meacham is with us now, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, former editor-in-chief of Newsweek, and professor at Vanderbilt and the University of the South. If you consume any political or intellectual media, you have probably heard John interviewed multiple times recently for his new book about the first President Bush called Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. But we invited John to come on with us despite this overexposure, because most of those interviews have grazed through various highlights of his 800-page work, and I want to take a deeper dive on one thing, Bush 41 and the first Iraq War. Full disclosure, I tend to think the first Iraq War gets entirely too much credit for being the good Iraq War and may have actually started us unnecessarily down the road to the horror show we're experiencing now, arguably much worse than if we had let Saddam Hussein keep Kuwait. I have a feeling John will largely disagree with that. But the book takes us deep behind the scenes on the decision to start that war. So let's see what's there. Hey, John Meacham, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure. My overexposed self sends warm regards to you.
That was not an insult, by the way. That was a backhanded compliment so much respect. So in August 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. Remind us what Saddam Hussein was after and what he got temporarily with that invasion.
He was after some oil fields. He was after more respect in the Arab world and beyond. There's some scholarship that suggests that the end of the Cold War unleashed him a bit because he thought that the superpowers was a longtime client state of Moscow's, but he thought that the superpowers were so busy with each other they might not be that interested in what he did. He moved fairly efficiently into Kuwait on the 2nd of August, 1990. Bush's initial reaction was, as he put it, that he was not contemplating intervention of any kind. There was not an instant awareness, an instant view in Washington that this was an invasion that had to be reversed. That developed over the ensuing 72-96 hours. Of the presidency. And one of the things that I found in doing this book, for which the president gave me his audio presidential diary, this was something that I do not believe had gotten the proper attention, and some of which was unknown until I went through this document, was that his spine was stiffened, not as popular memory has it, by Margaret Thatcher, but by the expectation and his fear that the Saudis were willing to strike some kind of deal with Saddam that would leave Saddam in Kuwait, and that ultimately Saddam might use that expanded mm-hmm. territory to go into Saudi Arabia itself. And Bush believed that if Saddam were to invade Saudi Arabia itself, that would lead to what, in his words, would lead to a new world war. And so by Sunday, August 5th, he steps off the helicopter, he walks over to the cameras, and he says, this will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait. And at that point, essentially, to go to your point, his mind was made up.
And I was shocked, shocked, John, to read in your book, because I didn't know it. Maybe, you know, other people knew it. But that after Iraq invaded Kuwait, President Bush said that perhaps Saudi Arabia needed protection from its own potential willingness to coexist with an expanded Iraq. So we were bigger war hawks on Saudi security than the Saudi leadership was?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I don't think it was fully understood, frankly, at least in my view, until now, because this was an evolution and a series of thoughts that the president expressed in parts of the diary that had not been published before.
And you have Jordan opposed to an invasion, and you even have Kuwait possibly willing to pay off Saddam and come to a financial settlement with him. Mere money rather than the mass death of war, but you have Margaret Thatcher warning Bush that that would be unacceptable. Why would that have been her judgment?
Well, she was hawkish. You know, Mrs. Thatcher was, you know, wanting to be hawkish before breakfast. I mean, her basic worldview was that was shaped by World War II, which makes sense given England's experience there. And she believed that no small state would be safe from any larger state if the invasion of Kuwait was allowed to stand. And so you had this, you know, bluntly, it was an imperial colonial view, frankly, from the Western powers of what was going on in the region, and while Jim Baker struggled mightily diplomatically, Bush himself, I think it's fair to say, pretty much from the 1st of August, believed that war was largely inevitable. because he had set out a set of demands, which was the which was withdrawal entirely from Kuwait. And Saddam, interestingly, and I think sort of, and this gets into a longer term question, as you were discussing, over the 20-year war with Saddam, that we 25-year war that's gone on, is, you know, one wonders why Saddam to decide to rattle this particular cage. It was a miscalculation, obviously, on Saddam's part, because militarily, once the United States and the coalition decided to do what they did, I don't think there was a great deal of real doubt but that Iraq would lose that war.
You write about an early meeting of Bush's top advisors after Iraq seized Kuwait, and Bush is a big hawk from day one, but most of the staff think it's halfway around the world, U.S. options are limited, and all in all, it's a highly complicated situation, as you quote them. And then even on the eve of the February U.S. invasion, you have Secretary of State James Baker and Vice President Dan Quayle not being at all sure what we're getting ourselves into. Baker said we might get bogged down in another Vietnam, and it's a big gamble. So domestically and internationally, Bush himself, plus Thatcher, was really the one spoiling for a fight to prove a point about who runs the post-Cold War world, wasn't he?
That would not be my phraseology, but I think the essential truth of what you're saying is right. I think Bush believed that he saw the world through the prism of World War II and through Vietnam. World War II in the sense that if you didn't stop dictators early, you paid a steeper price later. Vietnam in the sense that you applied overwhelming force and then you didn't second guess the generals once they were in the field. And so there's no question in my mind, having spent a great deal of time reading carefully and listening to the president's diary from August forward, but that he believed that the world he hoped to construct out of the end of the Cold War was being threatened by Saddam, was being threatened by this invasion, and that he had to reverse it in order to restore a certain kind of order that he believed was the right one for the world. Yeah.
Historian John Meacham, his new book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush, as 2016 marks the 25th anniversary of the U.S.'s military involvement with Iraq, which is still going on. And here we are 20 years later, John, and when it comes to Iraq today, the analysts are saying the same thing you quoted the skeptics in that first big meeting in 1990, saying U.S. options are limited and it's still a highly complicated situation. So in a way, we're right where we were when Bush 41 started down this road, but hundreds of thousands of people are dead or refugees. I mean, that's my critical take. Do you have a more positive way to look at the long-term impact of that first Iraq war?
Well, I mean, positive is a strong word. I mean, I think that historically speaking, George H.W. Bush set out a certain principle. It was a principle Franklin Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson would have acknowledged, would have understood, which was that unprovoked aggression from a large neighbor against a small neighbor to a territorial, violating the territorial integrity of another state, which created the potential for ongoing and larger problems for American national security and the stability of a given region, was at risk. And so he went to the UN. He did everything right. He went to Congress, won a very narrow vote in the Senate in particular, and built a 35-nation coalition, believed also, frankly, that it was important to show the world that America would go to bat for Arab people. It was the same kind of instinct that drove him to first put troops in Somalia after the election in 1992. He gave a remarkable speech from the Oval Office about Somalia and how important it was for America to be seen as willing to expend power, expend money, expend our treasure to help Muslim people, people of color, in the Somalia example.
Very so, different kind of engagement, that humanitarian engagement.
Sure. True. But from the same instinct. So I guess if you say positive or negative, I do think that the first Gulf War put Saddam in a box. President Bush Sr. was not at all pleased that Saddam had survived the war, foreshadowing, you know, other intelligence missteps along the way. You know, he had been told again and again that by our intelligence services, it was fully his expectation that Saddam would be taken out by his own people. He thought there would be uprisings. He thought there would be a coup. It never happened. He's very clear in his diary about how frustrating that is. But he was restrained about sticking within the exact letter of the mission as given to him by the UN. And so, so if there's a positive legacy, I guess it would be that the United States undertook a role of global leadership, reversed an aggression, and then stuck to its guns, did not, when the opportunity arose, did not break the terms of that engagement, didn't try to occupy a foreign land, defined its objective, accomplished its objective, and then pulled back.
Yeah, I guess it was really shocking to me to read that the Saudis might have been willing to come to some agreement with Iraq and avoid war that way, that even as Margaret Thatcher suggested it, maybe Kuwait, which was the victim of the invasion, may have found a political and financial accommodation with Saddam, and the war could have been avoided. And yet he and Thatcher were so hot to trot. Do you think that, I guess to my eye, it was too much Churchill when Saddam was not enough Hitler? Were she and Bush fighting their generations? Were she and Bush fighting their generation's last war?
No, that's a great question and a very, very good way to put it. I think it's fair to say that they were totally shaped by World War II, and they were trying to forge a kind of post-Cold War world where, as Bush once put it, the law of the jungle would not overwhelm the rule of law. And was there, you know, in retrospect, was more weight put on this conflict than the conflict itself merited? That's possible. But that's retrospective. I do think that, you know, you had a number of Democrats in real time arguing to allow sanctions to do their work. That's certainly reasonable. It's clear that this was not a, you know, 100% war, because I think the vote was, what, 52-48?
52-47 is what I think
yeah.
Reported 52-47. Yeah, so one person didn't vote. And that was another thing, looking back on that as the uncontroversial Iraq war, as people do, the uncontroversial Iraq war, when it was really quite controversial, 52-47. PolitiFact called it the thinnest authorization of the use of force since the War of 1812. Bernie Sanders was in the House. He voted against that war. Joe Biden was an opposition leader saying we should have given sanctions more time. Also, that U.S. troops in the coalition would be giving 95% of the sacrifice, and that war wasn't enough of a last resort for George H.W. Bush. So said Biden.
Your critique, Joe Biden
at the time.
Yeah. Now, your critique has much to it, unquestionably. And you also had a President Bush 41 who talked about Saddam Hussein in terms of good versus evil. You had a President Bush who was willing to go against the will of Congress if he had to go to war. He was willing to risk impeachment. He said this on five different occasions, privately and then public, and then sort of to his staff and others. He also said this.
That was also shocking to me in the book. And again, I don't know if I didn't know it. It was known to experts before, but that he had what looked to me in your book like little enough regard for the constitutional provision that it's Congress that declares war, at least authorizes it, that he was willing to go against a congressional vote if they didn't vote to authorize the war. That's, I don't know, that doesn't put him in a good light to me.
Well, he was certainly willing to do it. He believed in the rightness of his course. He believed that he had the executive authority to do it. Thought really, as I pulled that apart, trying to figure out exactly what he meant. I think what he thought was that if he didn't go to Congress and he went only with the UN authority, and then the war went badly, he might be impeached. If he went in the face of an active negative, that is, if he'd lost the Senate vote, if he'd lost the vote in the House, and he'd went to war anyway, and it went badly. He thought he might be removed from office. And that surprised me, unquestionably, the steadiness with which, I mean, the frequency with which he was contemplating that. But yeah, no, he was determined to do.
Yeah. Yet another revelation to me in your book, and you referred to it a minute ago, was that Bush wanted to expand the mission in mid-war to not just liberate Kuwait, but go all the way to Baghdad, topple Saddam, and do regime change. But he couldn't unilaterally expand the mission. And you're right that he felt despondent after the war because Saddam was still in power, which you say wounded Bush's competitive spirit. So I don't know if it was about competition, masculinity, I'm, you know, more powerful than you. But tell us more about why, after this successful mission to liberate Kuwait and his euphoria, as he described it, while the bombs were falling, that Bush would have felt despondent afterwards.
Well, because Saddam was there. And he says in his diary that there was no Battleship Missouri moment. There was no clear moment of victory. He didn't see it as a great triumph, interestingly, privately. Publicly, he said it was. But privately, and this is what's so interesting to me anyway, is he did not feel that it was an unalloyed victory because, again, he had expected Saddam to fall. He had expected there to be a kind of new day in Iraq. To his credit, he didn't think that the United States should go in and occupy and try to nation build. He thought that was unwise. He believed that the Arab partners would have broken off. Certainly some of the European partners would have broken off. He had a hard enough time keeping the Soviets in basic line. So it would have been a diplomatic nightmare, yeah, to have attempted to do it. Never seriously considered it.
I didn't see any reference in the book to Bush getting any intelligence report about the consequences of toppling Saddam. Did they have a clue about the Sunni-Shiite split and the kind of civil war that we know wound up erupting and that we're still dealing with after the 2003 Iraq war?
Yeah, no, they understood. They knew that this was a... I think more like a German post-war period than a Japanese one, if that makes sense. It was going to be that there was not going to be a supreme commander. You know, there wasn't going to be some sort of Douglas MacArthur figure going in to remake the nation. But he knew almost instantly that that the popularity numbers, you know, his 89%, 90% approval rating was soft. He knew long before pundits and his own staff came to him that it was going to be the economy in 1992. He was convinced he'd done the right thing, that he'd established a principle for the post-Cold War world.
So just tell me about that word. I know you got it.
I think to his credit. But
go ahead. Sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish the thought.
No, I think that he did want to try to make real that post-World War II vision of the world, mm-hmm. that the Cold War had complicated right. and overturned, which was a kind of, if you will, hard-headed Wilsonianism, if that's not an oxymoron.
I know you got to go in a minute. Let me just touch two other things. One was that I guess diary entry on the first day of the war, which people who were alive then remember it as looking like a video game to Americans on TV, Bush remembers a feeling of euphoria. What kind of man is it who can feel euphoria at a time like that, a kind of blanket bombing?
I do think that's an unfair characterization. This is a man who worried. He did worry about Iraqi life. He worried very much about American life. If you take the diary as a whole, this is someone who was understood what war really was. He's the last president to have combat experience, last president of World War II generation. I think that he was... you know, he was not euphoric about the fact of warfare. That's not right. Taken all in all, this is someone who took his responsibilities as commander in chief, and the fact that he had ultimate authority, and that his decisions shaped and would take other people's lives away was something that was very real to him, and he did not take it lightly at all.
So, tell me one final thing. Because after reading the Gulf War sections of your book, including Bush's strong feelings of despondency over not toppling Saddam, I wonder even more if George W. Bush came into office with a personal bias toward getting Saddam to complete his father's legacy that contributed to the second Iraq War, which by most people's lights has turned out to be such a colossal mistake. Did you look into it?
Absolutely, and I just don't think so. I think that Iraq had been, and you can argue that the inconclusive close to the first Gulf War created 10 years and more where Saddam was a perennial problem. But there was an act of Congress calling for regime change. President Clinton tried to keep Saddam in his box. Iraq was an ongoing problem in the 1990s. And on that, you know, you can make it quite to circle fully around to your first point. I mean, did the first Gulf War lead to the second Gulf War? Well, yes, in the sense that Saddam remained a problem and remained a threat to regional stability. I remember a very senior Democrat making a case in 2003, right before the second Gulf War, that the second Iraq War made sense, at least on the grounds that Saddam had always proven himself an irrational actor. That is, he invaded Iran when it was against his interest. He had challenged George Bush, the senior, when it was against his interest. He had, tried to get out of his box since then when it was against his interest. And
that was
if
when,
in fact, there was any chance that
I was just going to say, Clinton was enforcing a no-fly zone over Iraq, and here we are with another Clinton suggesting a no-fly zone over Syria, just saying.
Yeah, no. And you know, as Mark Twain said, history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. You're making a very interesting long-term historical point. My own view is that Bush found a way in the first Gulf War, the senior Bush, to exert American power for a limited and defined mission that was executed, and he pulled back when he could have done more that might have turned it into a more chaotic situation. He chose a path of order over chaos.
The book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. And there's a lot more in this 800-page book than what we've talked about. But, John Meacham, I really appreciate you being willing to take this deep dive with me into Gulf War I and those sections of the book.
No, it's an honor, and it's a thoughtful conversation, and one we should have about every time we exert power, because we always learn from the last war. And Lord knows we don't talk enough about the history of our enterprises beyond our borders.
Thanks again. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we know this is the day for coming up with New Year's resolutions, but before we hear about those new ones, we want to check in on how you did with your New Year's resolutions for 2015. And maybe doing this will help people make resolutions today that will actually improve their lives rather than sit on the dusty shelf of good intentions. And on January 2nd, 2015, we had a call in where we asked for your New Year's resolutions, and here's the first caller we got.
I started a gluten-free diet as of the 1st. My wife's gluten-free, and it gives me a better perspective on what I'm eating. I've been calorie counting, too, and it also just helps me in the life department, which always helps.
And here's Catherine from Manhattan, who wanted to change her occupation.
I'd like to explore running for city council in Manhattan.
All right. Who do you want to unseat?
Well, Dan Gorodnick is my representative now, and it's the end of his term.
Ah.
And so it's kind of it's really a good time for me to look into this and to bring something new to the table.
So Daniel Gorodnick is still the council member for the 4th District of New York, but maybe that doesn't mean Catherine didn't look into running for city council. And we heard plenty of other resolutions during that call-in, including John in the West Village making his 2015 New Year's resolution.
My resolution is to be less scared of death, which means that being an adult and kicking in with administrative plans, writing a will, asking people I love if they've written a will, asking them what their burial wishes are so that the survivors are not overwhelmed. It's a beautiful way to help out surviving family members. Not to be morbid, but plan your funeral or at least be, you know, open to talk about it.
So now we've got about 5 minutes to hear how those 2015 resolutions held up. Let's get right to the point. Eric in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. So my resolution last December was to get to inbox zero with my email. And unfortunately, I've got close to 20,000 emails left in the inbox.
Fail for Eric in Park Slope. Thanks for reporting in. What could have helped you succeed? Anything?
I don't know. You know, I started going back to the beginning to see if I could just throw things out wholesale. And unfortunately, there's a lot of relevant stuff there that needs to be put in folders. So,
right. So more folders. Eric, thank you. Or just more filing to folders. John in Fairfield, you're on WNYC. What was your resolution?
Hi, Brian. Happy holidays.
You too.
I gave up plastic bags. I did the best I could.
How much?
I think I cut back to maybe one. I'd say I had one big bag full of maybe 20 plastic bags by the end of the year, instead of maybe, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 big bagfuls.
Okay. Pretty much success. Claudia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. What was your resolution in 15?
Well, I decided to become a vegetarian because to do my personal part to fight climate change.
And did you stick to it?
Yep.
How much do you crave meat?
I love meat. I mean, the taste of meat is delicious, but I thought, you know, if we just wait for the government to do stuff that needs to be done by the government to fight climate change. I think that we should do our part and consume differently.
Claudia, thank you very much. I'm glad you were able to stick to it. Anne in Manhattan, what was your New Year's resolution?
My New Year's resolution was to see my daughter more often. We both live in the city and have really crazy schedules.
So nice.
I made a resolution to have lunch with her at least once a month, and we did it.
Yay. Maureen in New Brunswick. What was your resolution? Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. My resolution was to try to floss at least once a day to save my teeth.
And?
I say I did it about 90% of the time, and I still have all my teeth, so good thing.
90% definitely counts as success. 212-433-WNYC. What was your main New Year's resolution for 2015? How about
Carrie
in Greenwich? Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Well, my resolution was to spend less time listening to WNYC.
And?
Well, you are to blame for its tremendous failure.
Carrie, keep on failing. Carol in Fort Greene, what was your resolution in 2015?
Hi. Yeah, I have a solo show that's kind of been my life's passion. I've been developing it for a couple of years, and this last year I went all out, put about $15,000 into producing a full two-week run at Theater for the New City, and then based on that, we toured it down to Philly. We just took it out to Long Island, and I just got back yesterday from doing the show in Boston, and it is going amazingly.
Yay, success. Invested in her own show. Alex in Park Slope. Hi, Alex. What was your New Year's resolution?
Hi, Brian. Happy New Year. My New Year's resolution is that I'm writing, as of right now, my letter of resignation to the United States Census Bureau. You're the first one to know.
Resignation? And you work for the Census Bureau?
I have worked for the United States Census Bureau. I'm very proud of having served in public service for five years.
And is this a principled resignation for some reason?
Both. It is. It has become a principled resignation because Congress has willfully suppressed the effectiveness of government, especially since October 2013 with budget cuts. And we at the Census have been suffering miserably for the past 2 years. It's getting worse and worse.
And Alex, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you. Howard in Montclair, your New Year's resolution in 2015?
To not judge people, to be less judgmental.
Oh, but people are so, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, we all are, because we have this whole thing of right and wrong and even a hierarchy of what's right and wrong.
I'm trying to bait you into breaking your resolution.
Well, it's just to be conscious of it. If you're conscious of it, you'll do it less, I think.
Thank you very much. Hilda in Brooklyn, you get the last one. What was your resolution?
It was to not text and walk, to make sure I am completely aware. And I found that I got probably all the way through May until, you started to look around.
May. But 5 months of mindfulness as a pedestrian. Hilda, thanks. And thanks to all of you who called in with your 2015 resolutions. Good luck with your 16 ones.